This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Our guest is Laurie Nelson Spielman, whose third novel has just been published. Laurie Nelson Spielman is a New York Times, USA Today, and internationally best-selling author, whose two previous novels were a huge hit, reaching number one in six different countries. Formerly, she was a homebound teacher in an inner-city school district and later a high school guidance counselor. She holds master's degrees in speech pathology and guidance counseling. Her newest book, The Star-Crossed Sisters of Tuscany, has just been published. The book tells the story of two cousins, Amelia and Lucy Fontana, and their great aunt, Poppy Fontana, who all believe they are cursed. In fact, according to family legend, since the day Philomena Fontana cast a curse upon her sister, more than 200 years before, not one second-born Fontana daughter has found lasting love. Some, like second-born Amelia, a single baker working in her grandfather's Brooklyn deli, believe it's nothing more than an odd coincidence. Others, like her sexy, desperate-for-love cousin Lucy, are convinced it's a true hex. But both are equally intrigued when their great-aunt calls with an outlandish proposition. If they will accompany her to her homeland of Italy, Aunt Poppy vows she will meet the love of her life on the steps of the Ravello Cathedral on her 80th birthday, soon to come, and she will break the Fontana second daughter curse once and for all. The novel tells two stories, one in the present with Poppy, Amelia and Lucy in Venice, and later on the Amalfi Coast in Italy. The other is Poppy's story, set in the early 1960s in Italy. As you'll hear in this excerpt, the book begins with Amelia talking about her life, living like Cinderella, trapped in the back room of a bakery in Brooklyn.
72 cannoli shells cool on a baking rack in front of me. I squeeze juice from diced maraschino cherries and carefully fold them into a mixture of cream and ricotta cheese and powdered sugar. Through a cloudy rectangular window in the back kitchen, I peer into the store. Lucchese Bakery and Delicatessen is quiet this morning, typical for a Tuesday. My grandmother, Nonna Rosa Fontana Lucchese, stands behind the deli counter, rearranging the olives, stirring stainless steel containers of roasted peppers and feta cheeses. My father pushes through the double doors, balancing a tray heaped with sliced prosciutto. With tongs, he transfers it into the refrigerated meat case, creating a stack between the pancetta and capicola. At the front of the store, behind the cash register, my older sister, Daria, rests her backside against the candy counter, her thumbs tapping her phone. No doubt she's texting one of her girlfriends, probably complaining about Donnie or the girls. Dean Martin's That's Amore streams through the speakers, a final reminder of my late grandfather, who insisted Italian music created an aura of authenticity in his bakery and delicatessen. Never mind that this one's an American song sung by an American singer. And I have nothing against my deceased grandfather's musical taste, except that our entire repertoire of Italian music spans 33 songs. 33 songs I can, and sometimes do, sing word for word in my sleep. I turn my attention to the cannoli, piping cream into the 6 dozen hollow shells. Soon the music fades. The smell of pastry vanishes. I'm far away in Somerset, England, lost in my story. She waits on the Clevedon Pier, gazing out to sea, where the setting sun glitters upon the rippling waters. A voice calls. She spins around, hoping to find her lover, but there, lurking in the shadows, her ex. I jump when the bell on the wall beside me chimes. I hitch up my glasses and peer through the window. It's Mrs. Fortino, bearing a bouquet of orange and yellow Gerbera daisies. Her silver hair is pulled into a sleek chignon, and a pair of beige slacks shows off her slim figure. From behind the meat counter, my father straightens to his full 5-foot-10-inch frame and sucks in the belly protruding from his apron. Nonna watches, her face puckered, as if she's just downed a shot of vinegar. Buongiorno, Rosa! Mrs. Fortino chirps as she strides past the deli counter. Nonna turns away, muttering, Squaldrina! The Italian word for floozy. Mrs. Fortino makes her way to the mirror, as she always does, before approaching my father's meat counter. The mirror doubles as a window, which means that unbeknownst to her, Mrs. Fortino is gazing into the same window I'm peering out of from the kitchen. I step back while she checks her lipstick, the same shade of pink as her blouse, and smooths her hair. Satisfied, she wheels around to where my dad stands behind the meat counter. "For you, Leo." She smiles and holds the daisies in front of her. My grandmother gives a little huff, like a territorial goose, hissing at anyone who so much as glances at her baby gosling. Never mind that the gosling is her 66-year-old son-in-law who's been widowed for almost 3 decades. My balding father takes the daisies, his cheeks flaming. He thanks Mrs. Fortino, as he does every week, and sneaks a peek at my nonna. Nonna stirs the marinated mushrooms, making believe she's paying no attention whatsoever. "Have a nice day, Leo," Mrs. Fortino says, and gives him a pretty little wave. "Same to you, Virginia." My father's hand searches for a vase beneath the counter, but his eyes follow Mrs. Fortino down the aisle. My heart aches for them both.
Laurie Nelson Spielman reading from one of the introductory chapters in her new novel, The Star-Crossed Sisters of Tuscany. I talked to Laurie by phone from her home in Michigan. I found it really interesting, the advice that you gave to aspiring writers. The first sentence is so grabby. Sorry. Just keep trying, never give up. I think that's such a good idea. And then you go on to say, if I hadn't put away that first novel and started a new one, and then another, and then another. How many novels did you begin before you finished the one that was hugely successful, right? I mean, it was successful here in America and has been translated and published in other countries. I mean, that seems to be the acid test, you know, when they're going to translate your work into another language for an entirely different audience.
That was truly just thrilling, and I had no, absolutely no expectation of that. You know, when you're writing, you just hope your home country sells 5 copies. You just want it to be out there.
Yeah.
I was floored by that. And that's all thanks to my agent, Jenny Bent. But yeah, I had written 3 full novels and a screenplay, all of which collected rejection letters. Every time I would get a rejection letter, actually you query to agents, and every time I would receive a letter from an agent, I would say, not this one, put it away, and I just kept at it. Finally, after close to 100 query letters that weren't garnering any attention, then I finally would look at the manuscript and say, not this one, put it away. And that's hard. It's really hard to do. But I just see so many young writers, and you do get so attached to your work. You hate to put it away, but sometimes, I just heard the other day, the average writer doesn't get published until their 5th novel. That's a lot of putting away and saying, not this one.
Isn't it just? Especially when you consider the, as you said, the amount of time you put into writing a book, which everybody knows, but when you say it the way you did, well, days go into months and months go into years, and you think, whoa, so this is a significant chunk of your life that's gone into writing a novel.
It really is, and you feel like, you know, I'm just wasting time here. This is time that I could be spending with my nieces and nephews. And it's not like another hobby where maybe you're an artist and your work doesn't become famous, but you can still hang it on your wall. Or you can, you know, if you're sewing, you can wear your products. But with writing, try hauling out your 300-page manuscript and asking people if they'd like to take a look. It's not something that you share. It does feel like a waste of time. But it is also, you've got to enjoy what you're doing. And I do love when I'm lost in a story.
Yeah, I can understand that. One thing that occurred to me while you were talking was somebody told me one time about songwriting, that a song doesn't exist until somebody hears it.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's good.
And that's kind of what you're saying about the novel, right? That
But at the same time, it isn't.
You're writing it because you just want to tell this story. And if nobody ever reads it, you've at least told this story, and you've done something that you've set yourself a goal and you realized it. The bigger goal, of course, is to get somebody else to read it. But
right. That's the harder goal.
That's more complicated, isn't it? And I'm wondering if that's why, at least to me, it appears that Amelia, who is the central character, and I think probably she is the central character in the Star-Crossed Sisters, even though, as the title implies, there's more than one person involved in this story.
Right.
Amelia and Brett, it seems to me, both of them have been challenged with a task, a goal, if you will, that is going to upend their lives. And I'm wondering if, you know, your experience as a fledgling writer, if that is what draws you to write that kind of story, where you're telling a story effectively about how somebody can turn their life around and realize a goal that perhaps from their point of view, I mean, let's just talk about Amelia, you know, poor little Amelia. You know, she's almost like a little Cinderella character, you know?
She is. And you're right, I probably... Taurus the Bull is my astrological sign, and I can be very stubborn. So I do like a character who goes after what they want. And I think that's important to a story. In the beginning, Amelia, sort of like Cinderella, is kind of pushed around and has to then find her voice and rise up and become independent and strong. And I do gravitate towards stories like that.
Yeah, she doesn't have an ugly stepsister or two, but she has a kind of ugly grandmother. She's kind of harsh with her, you know?
Yeah, she would be like the evil stepmother, but she's the evil grandmother. She's a very bitter, angry woman who rules with an iron fist. She owns the bakery where Amelia works. She owns the home where Amelia rents her apartment. She has total control over Amelia, and early on Amelia, that's all she knows, and she allows it. And she also, what's worse, is allows her grandmother to make her believe that she's not worthy.
Well, I thought that the observation, and there are many made by Poppy, who's her grandmother's sister, so she's Amelia's great aunt. Poppy is a wonderful source of these life aphorisms, if you will. One of which really resonated when she said, isn't it ironic that, and I think it's true of many of us, that we have this tendency to live up to and often down to the person others have framed us as being, especially within families. And that seems to be what happened to Amelia, you know?
Absolutely. That curse, which is nothing more than a self-fulfilling prophecy, really permeates into the second daughter's personalities, and it establishes this pecking order in the family where there's suddenly the subordinate child and treated like second class, you know, citizens in their family structure. So and then when they're treated that way or thought to be unworthy, then they start believing it themselves. Luckily, in keeping with the Cinderella analogy, the fairy godmother comes in, who is Aunt Poppy, and tries to bring Amelia out of her shell and have her experience love and life and the things that she has really denied herself up until then.
Yeah, that's such a nice idea. And I guess, you know, one of the takeaways from that is if you're open to it, it will come to you. The reason it doesn't is because you're closed, right?
I love that. That's right. Like Poppy would say, instead of saying it's impossible, she would say it's possible. You know, as long as you stop believing that it's impossible, surprising how many things will come to you.
Spoken like a ideal guidance counselor. you must have been very popular.
I loved that job. That was really fun.
I can see why you would. In some ways, your writing seems to be an extension of that.
Oh, that's nice.
The other thing, first of all, I have to tell you, right, that as more than one person has observed, you are a great storyteller. And one of the reasons that I like your work so much, and at least I should be clear, that this isn't the only book of yours that I've read, but this book, and forgive me if this sounds sexist, it's not meant to, but it may come across that way, that romance novels are often, it seems to me, the realization of a fantasy on the part of the reader. And so as such, they can sometimes stretch the bounds of reality. But the beauty of what you write is that such wonderful twists and so many counterintuitive events in the lives of these young women. There's Lucy and Amelia, they're cousins, they're both the second born. But Lucy is not willing to just bow down like Amelia. She's much more forthright and, it seems to me, self-assured, at least on the surface anyway, self-assured personality.
Yeah, they couldn't be more different.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Lucy's mother is one of these mothers who is desperate for her daughter to get married and have children one day. And so Lucy feels enormous pressure from her mother and her family to break this curse. But yes, she's spunky. Lucy has a lot of backbone, where Amelia just lets people, in the beginning, just lets people take advantage of her as if she doesn't deserve any better.
You have an incredible ability to draw very realistic three-dimensional characters, not only in their personality, but also in the experiences that they have. It's not predictable. Just when you think, oh, I know where this is going, it doesn't. It takes a left turn and goes, and you're like, whoa, I wasn't ready for that. You know? And that happens in every other chapter. You know, it's really...
That's very nice of you to say, but I have to tell you my secret for that. It was one of my early books that I submitted, and an agent in New York City, his name was Daniel Lazar, asked to read pages, and I got, you know, you always get excited when an agent wants to read pages. Then he asked for the full manuscript, and I'm like, yes. Well, he sent it back eventually, and he said, you know, I think you have talent, but it just didn't have enough surprises for me. It was one of my early works. And so, of course, I was brokenhearted, but I said to myself, he's right, for one thing. It was a pretty predictable book. So I decided I was going to give myself a homework assignment, and I was going to write a book that had more zigs and zags than a Zumba class. I mean, it just, every time it tried to go one way, I would force it to go another. And I thought to myself, I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to put that book away, and the next book I write after that is going to be the one that sells. And so that's what I did. I spent a year just trying to make a book with lots of surprises. And then I put it away. Nobody's ever read it. And then I wrote The Life List. So I owe a lot to Daniel Lazar, even though he passed on my book.
That's interesting. So in effect, you set yourself a sort of intellectual exercise. It was less about telling a story than it was about creating endless, as you said, zags when you think it's going to zig, and vice versa.
Exactly. Yes. I think it's so easy to get caught in going where the book naturally would go, and the reader knows where it's going to go too. So I think it's the author's job to prevent that so that it gives surprises to the reader.
Right. I think that's what makes your book work. It is a wonderfully romantic tale, but there are enough setbacks and events that could never have been predicted that makes it feel that this is not a fantasy. This is the lives of two real people with a rather eccentric great aunt who've gone to spend a week with her in Italy while she goes on her equally chaotic journey to find the man with whom she fell in love when she was just barely out of her teens.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I love the story about, you know, you based his character. He is from East Germany.
Yes.
Called Eric.
Yes.
Or Rico, as he came to be known by Poppy. Because she wanted to give him an Italian name. You knew somebody like Eric.
I do, and it was a wonderful story that right after the Life List was published in Germany, I received a 6-page, single-space typed letter from this man. He's an elderly man who grew up during World War II. His name is Dieter. He goes by Dito. And he told me his life story, and he asked if I would write it. And I wrote him back telling him, you know, I don't write biographies, but his story was fascinating. Anyway, we have become pen pals, and we even met in person a couple of years ago. And I just got a huge box of chocolates from him. We write every day. We email each other. He's just a dear. But his story of escaping East Germany after the wall was erected and leaving behind the love of his life. It was just such a bittersweet story. He went on to become a world famous juggler. But I wanted to use parts of his story for the Rico character, for the Eric character, who's in Italy after leaving East Germany. So he gave me his permission, and he was delighted. I dedicated the book to him and his late wife.
She was his sweetheart?
Yes, she was the one that he had to leave behind early. He went back and got her. So he actually escaped East Germany twice.
Wow. The details in that part of the story are really interesting, which, of course, could equally be said of the details about life in Bensonhurst, which my guess would be that for most people, that's just a name. They may know Saturday Night Fever, which I didn't know Saturday Night Fever was shot in Bensonhurst, but now I do. It makes perfect sense. But
right.
You get so inside a very specific culture, Italian people who are living here in America, but kind of have, as I guess is true for anybody who leaves their home and goes to live in another country, there's always a part of you that's in the other country all the time.
Right. I am lucky that I have wonderful friends, Joe and Elaine Natoli, who grew up in Bensonhurst. They live in Michigan now, but just love to tell stories of their extended family growing up with the, you know, Nona and Nono living upstairs and the aunts and uncles. And I'm so envious of that sort of extended family and the traditions and the culture. They were wonderful sources of, you know, for the Fontana family, lots of information from them.
I'm still trying to understand how this whole process works. You are getting all of this information, as you said, you protesting the whole time, I'm sure, did research where you ate and drank a lot of good food and good wine.
Yes.
From Italy.
Yes.
So you absorb all of these information, insights, experiences from other people, your friend's stories from Bensonhurst, Dieter's story from East Germany, Poppy's story, which I guess that's kind of ancillary to the Bensonhurst story, really, isn't it? Because she didn't spend very much time in Bensonhurst,
right.
Did she?
No, she didn't.
So, you know, this is a long, complicated story, and you tell it so beautifully. And, it's a story of people, three different people, all of whom have a goal and are pursuing it. But then at the same time, every second or third chapter, there's the flashback to Poppy's backstory, which is another equally complicated and compelling tale of another life in another generation.
It was tricky. It's the first one I've done. I've done that way with two points of view, and it just, I always, you know, you worry that the reader's going to get taken out of the first story and then, you know, not be able to get back into it. And so that, I actually wrote Poppy's story in total and then cut it and inserted it.
Just to make things a bit more complicated for yourself, you have Poppy and her story in the 50s and early 60s. Is it about the time frame for the
yes.
for her original
uh-huh.
story?
Yep.
And then, of course, you've got the contemporary story.
Right.
The Poppy's right. contemporary story. And then the story of Amelia and Lucy, and then the story of Lucy, Amelia, and Poppy.
Well, if I had known it was that complicated, I would have been way too lazy to write it.
But it doesn't seem complicated. That's what's so cool about it. It seems very organic the way it flows.
Oh, well, I appreciate you saying that.
Well, it seems to me that with the rather complex structure of your novel, it must have helped to have an editor help you organize it, huh?
Yes, she was great. And she also was really good at, I tend to like, you know, just get to the action, the dialogue. She kept saying, more details, put more details about Italy. This was before the pandemic. And I kept thinking, really? Do people really want to read about, you know, what Venice looks like? But she really, she said, you need to make the reader feel like they're sitting right there in Italy. And now with the pandemic, when everyone is starving for travel, I think she was prescient when she was giving me the advice, because I know I would love to be traveling right now. So if a book can take us somewhere, that's nice.
You said you wrote a screenplay, and in some ways a novel is a bit like a screenplay, isn't it?
It is. The screenplay has a lot less description and a lot more just a couple lines of setting the scene and then dialogue, lots more dialogue heavy. So for me, and it's a lot shorter too, usually 120 pages is a two-hour feature film. But yeah, I like that sort of writing. So that was kind of a stretch, really trying to add more details and more details. But I'm so glad I did. Sarah was right.
And I would think if you, even though you are primarily writing dialogue, you have to be able to see those characters and where they are in your mind's eye, don't you, to be able to write it?
Absolutely. I visualize the entire thing, yes. And I'm hoping my reader will too, when, you know, that they'll have their own picture. If I describe it well enough, they can just visualize it as they read.
So in effect, your novel is a screenplay with you providing the pictures.
Yeah, I'm the director, I guess.
And it's so much fun, and I think it works.
Thank you.
Well, it's been great talking to you.
You were just a delight. Lots of fun to talk with you.
At a time when the pandemic has removed even the possibility of a winter break in Italy, in the sunshine, by the sea, this tale will take you there in your imagination. The Star-Crossed Daughters of Tuscany by Laurie Nelson-Spielman has just been published after several delays caused by the pandemic. This is Scenic Roots, talking writing on listener-supported public radio.